The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're fortunate to have John Heflin back with us today to answer your questions about the topics we've talked about the last couple of weeks. Welcome back, John.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Well, I've heard nice things about your episode. Thanks so much for being here and thanks for coming back.
Oh, glad to. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to listen to them myself. I'm afraid of what I sound like, so.
It's never the way you think. Let's dive right in. Do you have any conflicts to disclose?
I do. I am a consultant for Globus Medical and Orthopediatrics. I get royalties from both, actually.
All right. Let's dive right in. The first question is kind of a nerdy question, and I admit this one came from me. What can you tell me about scoliosis bracing compliance monitors? Are they in common use? Do they help? And is there anything I can do to support bracing compliance in my patients?
Well, so they are in use. The most common type is a thermal monitor, so it's actually embedded in the PLSO brace itself. And it basically just measures the temperature. And so if you're in the brace, it's going to measure your body temperature and tell you how long, you know, how frequently you're in your brace. And I think they do help because they tattle on the patient, you know. So if the patient comes into the office and you can call them out on, you know, they're like, oh, I wear it 14 hours a day. And it says, you know, it looks like you wear it about three. They have a tendency to want to wear it more so they can stay out of trouble. But what I find is that they wear it more, like they won't wear it for several days. And then as they're getting close to their appointment, then they'll wear it a whole lot more, trying to make up for it. So compliance is a very difficult thing. Girls are historically a lot better than boys. They have terrible compliance rates. Some people say between 5% and 15%. So boys are pretty tough to get them to wear their braces. I've gotten around that a little bit by placing them into nighttime Providence bending braces for smaller curves up to about 30 degrees. And there's some literature that would support that that's actually a viable way of handling smaller curves. But when you start moving into the daytime braces, it really comes down to parents taking control and taking charge of making sure that their children are in the braces. Some parents do, some parents don't. So I really try to, you know, encourage the child to take ownership of their problem and for the parents to encourage them to try to wear their brace as much as we would ask of them. And then showing them some, you know, some kids that have had spine surgery, the rods and screws can sometimes be helpful as a demonstration of, you know, this is what happens if it gets too big. Sometimes we end up having to do surgical corrections and, you know, nobody wants to go down that path. And so it's not really a threat as much as it is an illustration of what might happen.
Well, it seems to me, too, that in some ways it's almost like the Fitbit effect, that for some kids, at least, it allows them to track their progress. And for me as a pediatrician, knowing that such a thing exists, it just gives me a point of contact that I can ask patients about and ask them how they're doing with it. So that's very helpful to know. Ready for the next question?
Sure.
So how common is lumbar disc herniation in kids? Why does it happen? What should I be looking for, and how does that affect lifelong risk of back pain and disease?
Disc herniations in kids are actually quite rare. The numbers that are thrown around are between 0.1 and 0.5%. You know, the pediatric population will have a disc herniation during their pediatric years. It may be more or less than that. It's really somewhat hard to gauge. And disc herniation in kids is a little bit different than in adults because much of the time, it's the disc will herniate as a function of an extreme axial load, like jumping off of something really tall or picking up a heavy object, like deadlifting or something, and they can have a disc herniation. But unlike us, where the annulus has a tendency to tear and then extrude disc material into the canal or to get a big bleb from the, you know, annulus itself, kids have a tendency to tear off part of the epiphysis of the vertebral body. They can actually pull off a piece of the growth plate. And that chunk of bone, it's called the popsial ring avulsion. That chunk of bone can actually continue to grow despite the fact that it's been plucked off. And so it can actually get a little bit larger as a fragment. And that's problematic because it doesn't go away. Like in adults, if you wait long enough, you know, if you look at two-year outcomes between a disc herniation that's treated surgically and one that's treated conservatively, they look roughly the same. In children, they don't do that. They don't go away. They don't desiccate because their discs are healthy and water. So once they have a ring avulsion, they have a ton of pain and it doesn't get better. And it often causes a radiculopathy. And so most of those we end up having to actually operate on and do effectively what's a microdiscectomy and an excision of that apophyseal ring fragment. As far as, you know, what does that mean down the road? Well, once you've damaged your disc, I think you're at risk for having additional disc problems as you get older. So, you know, I don't know exact numbers on, you know, who goes on to needing a discectomy or a fusion, but it is a setup for problems later. And you can actually see if you get an MRI down the road, if you've done a microdiscectomy on a kid for an apophyseal ring avulsion, the disc will be darker, which would suggest that it is desiccating. So the disc is a lot less healthy than the ones around it. So we know that they're certainly at risk later on of having more problems.
Does that either suggest or require any activity modification for those kids?
Well, I think the problem is you have to live your whole life with these,
yeah,
with these discs. And so, you know, if you were to tell a kid, well, you've injured your disc, you're going to have to shut down your activity forever. You know, they're of course not going to listen to that as a reasonable response. And I would never ask that of a child anyway.
Sure. Sure.
We do tell them, you know, after you have an injury, after we've gone in and removed the fragment, that you're going to have to shut down your activities for about 3 to 4 months while it heals. And beyond after that, I kind of let them get back to doing whatever they do. And you just cross your fingers and hope for the best down the long road.
Very helpful. Okay. Next question. Is there a connection between back pain and headache in kids? It seems I'm seeing more of both, and I wonder how much to attribute to using keyboards for school and then devices all the rest of their waking hours. Thoughts?
It's interesting. The back pain and headache combo is something that's been a curiosity for people for a long time. There are direct reasons why you can have headaches associated with back issues. So if you have a PRA malformation and you have a large cord syrinx, those things can be associated with back pain and scoliosis and other neuromuscular issues. And certainly those kids have a lot of headaches. If you have a mm-hmm. PRA malformation, that's one of the main symptoms that you look for is headache and visual disturbances and things of that nature. But also the syrinx can bring on back pain. So obviously you want to be aware of that as a possible cause. Then of course, if you've had a sick child, you got to be, you know, concerned about meningitis and other really sure. bad stuff. But from, you know, from a, just a musculoskeletal back pain and its association with headaches, you know, there was a Swedish study that was done a year or so ago that looked at sort of the association between the two, and they were found to come together, you know, at some rate. But what I thought was fascinating about the study was that kids that have a combination of headaches and back pain have a tendency to have a higher incidence of chronic pain later on in life for reasons that nobody understands. They didn't really try to understand the reasoning for that, but it seems that kids that have chronic headaches and chronic pain in their back at least have some risk of going on to having chronic pain later. You know, whether there's a cause and effect there or whether it's just a non-related relationship is hard to know.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly would agree with you that I see more kids coming in complaining of both, actually. And I think there is a correlation between, you know, dropping your head forward and all your strap muscles of your neck pulling on the back of your head all day, giving you, you know, occipital-based headaches and also having pain in the upper part of your thoracic spine between your shoulder blades, because that's where the muscle sort of connects top and bottom, right? And so it would seem natural that if you have your head tucked forward, which most people don't have any idea how much their head weighs. And I often ask that of children, like, how much do you think your head weighs? You know, assuming there's a brain in it. And the answer is about as much as a bowling ball, 15, 16 pounds. So that's a lot of weight to sort of dangle out in front of yourself and expect those muscles to hold it up all day long. And I think that can result in sort of a chronic fatigue type pain at the base of the neck. And I think that it can also precipitate headaches. And so I do think this text neck phenomenon is actually a real thing, you know, where you're just leaning forward all day long and you start getting these aches and pains that then turn into a chronic fatigue problem, then I think can result in headaches and other issues.
It really just does seem striking to me. And I don't, you know, when I ask kids about it, they don't see it the same way. But if you look at any group of human beings currently, everyone is bent over a phone. And I don't think anyone really factors in how much time they're spending with their head in an unnatural position.
I don't think so. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we do that's unnatural. You know, if you think about how we develop, we, you know, run around out in the woods on relatively soft ground, you know, chasing things down all day. So we're ambulatory creatures. We're supposed to be upright. And, you know, we developed on surfaces that were relatively soft. If you look at what we do now, right, we sit most of the day. We walk around on what effectively is stone all day. You know, and we're really not, I don't know that we're really built for either of those environmental conditions. And on top of that, now we are hunched over in a ball looking at a phone rather than looking forward. You know, if we were looking at the ground the whole time as we were developing, we would have either gotten eaten or walked off a cliff.
Right.
I definitely think all these things have contributed.
Yeah, definitely not scanning our horizon for what may be going on. Instead, we're looking down and talking with our thumbs. All right. Well, I'm sure we can fix that. The next question is about seven questions posing as one question. What do you recommend to young athletes about weight training? You talked a little bit about the effects of incorrect posture with weight training on back pain. Is there a minimum age? Should they avoid free weights until a certain age? Is there any advantage of low load, high rep versus high load training? And how can you ensure that kids are getting good technique to avoid injury?
So it's interesting because, you know, forever, people have talked about, well, kids don't need to be doing resistance training when they're young, that they're going to cause injuries to their physis, they're going to have, you know, growth disturbances, they're going to have other problems. The truth of the matter is it's been looked at pretty closely, and there appears to really be no correlation between resistance training and growth plate injuries when the lifting is done correctly. And I think that's the key. So by, you know, correct lifting, that would imply correct amount of weight, which would mean that, you know, you are picking up a weight that you can actually manage and you're doing it correctly for a number of reps. And the only way that you can ensure that that's happening is you would have to have a trainer actually work with you. So a coach or somebody who has some idea what correct lifting technique looks like. But as far as somebody saying, oh, well, you know, your 8-year-old should not be lifting weights because that's not good for them, there's actually no scientific basis for that at all. And so I think that it's something that kids can do. And in fact, there's been at least a little bit of work done as of, you know, March of 2024, looking at the correlation between resistance training and obesity in kids that are preteen. And it appears that kids that are involved in resistance training early build up more self-esteem and confidence and have a tendency to be more active and to stay away from sedentary activities more so than kids that don't. And, you know, whether that's causal or not, it's hard to say, but there certainly does appear to be a relationship. So, you know, I would encourage kids to do resistance training. I would encourage them to do aerobic activities, to run distances, to swim. I think it's going to be very hard to injure a child with well-focused and well-monitored activity, you know. And I think actually we would all be better off if we were doing a little bit of weight training and resistance training early on in life and develop that as a habit, you know, mm-hmm. became something we did over the course of our lifetimes. Certainly lifting weights, even as an elderly person, is a good thing for muscle tone and bone health, just for overall longevity. So, you know, I think that's something we should be starting early, and I think it should be something that we carry through life.
Terrific. Last question is a tough one. Do you have any tips to help persuade young athletes to rest an injury?
That is a super hard thing to do, you know, because, you know, a lot of children who are big time athletes who run into current use injuries and that sort of thing, those kids are really hard to shut down because that's their life. That's kind of everything to them in many instances. And many kids sort of define their person by what they do. Mm-hmm. And so shutting them down is really quite difficult. What I do for the kids that I deal with who have repetitive use injuries is I tell them, you know, if you look at your athlete heroes out there, the baseball players, the football players, the tennis players, these people make their living doing a sport, and they're really, really good at it. But by contract, most of these guys, once they're in their off season, can't play organized sports. They actually have to heal. It's because they're an investment in these organizations. And so they want them to play at their optimal performance. And how do they do that? They let them heal. I said, part of the problem that you guys, you gymnasts and dancers and, you know, lacrosse players and soccer players have is that you play until your body starts to break, and then you're not able to play at the level that you want to play. And so I think you need to give yourself a period of time to heal. How long is that period of time? So you need a good 2 months off to get yourself back into a place where you've recovered from your constant pounding and abuse, and let yourself heal so that you can be a better athlete, so that you can perform at a level that you really want to perform at. Because I can assure you that if you play 12 months a year, you won't play as well as you do if you played for 10. And that's kind of the argument and the reasoning that I try to use. I also tell them that, you know, if you go out there and you tear yourself up, you know, rather than having 2 months off, you're going to have 6 months off,
right?
Possibly a lifetime off.
Right.
So I think it's better to tackle the recovery process and learn how to be an athlete off the field, you know.
Right. Great advice. Well, anything else you want to share?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this has been a fantastic experience. I really enjoyed chatting and letting you in on what I know. So I guess now you can go out and, you know, be a spine guy if you want to, or whatever.
We'll look forward to talking to you again, John. Thanks so much for your time and your expertise. And thanks to our listeners for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.